The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, Phillies fans and sports lovers. Tonight I have the pleasure of welcoming back Tyler Kepner, national baseball writer for the New York Times. As some of you may know, Kepner began his writing career as a teenager in the suburbs of Philadelphia, interviewing players for a homemade magazine that brought him national attention. His first book, The Phillies Experience, a year-by-year chronicle of the Philadelphia Phillies, was later followed by his national bestseller, K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches, which earned praise from fans, fellow sports writers, and Hall of Fame pitchers alike. In his latest home run, The Grandest Stage, Tyler uses interviews, baseball lore, and behind-the-scenes anecdotes to offer an entertaining and surprising 117-year history of the World Series. It's great to have him back. Please welcome Tyler Kepner.
Thanks, Andy. So Andy tells me they were warming up the crowd with highlights from Game 3 of the World Series. I guess that was game 1 or 3. You pick one or the other. Interesting series, though, right? Phillies started off with a win, and then they tied it, Houston. Then Phillies had the big win here, and then Houston won it. But it was certainly a memorable ride in October, and I was happy to be here to chronicle it. I grew up, as Andy was saying, out in the suburbs in Flower Town and then Gwinnett Valley. And when I went to Germantown Academy, a couple of my best friends in the world are here from GA. And actually, John there, he and I started a little baseball magazine together in 1988, I think, seventh grade. We had the same exact class schedule. And so we just found ourselves sitting next to each other in the back of the classroom. Some classes weren't so exciting, and we would just sort of jot down little baseball lists and trivia games and you know, logos and articles, and we turned it into this little magazine and copied it and, you know, stapled it together, sold it to our friends and our brother's friends, and the next summer after eighth grade, I realized that, oh my God, this could be my thing. You know, this could be, because I always wanted to be, I love Major League Baseball more than anything. And, you know, you sort of think, well, how can I get into that world? And if you're not a player, and I was okay, but I was not like a pro prospect by any means at all. So it was like, well, if I'm not going to play, like, how do you get into this baseball world? How do you spend your career around that? And I just sort of realized this was something that I really took to. You know, I was lucky to grow up at you know, to catch just the end of that Phillies run in, you know, from the mid-70s to the early 80s, to where I was hooked on baseball. And then I was hooked on sports writing. You know, sports writers like Jason Stark in this town, you know, were role models and then have become really close friends. But so I just realized, like, this is what I want to do. So luckily, my dad had been in the Army Reserves with David Montgomery and was a longtime friend of his. So David was kind enough to, I think, nudge his PR staff, like, hey, you know, this is a friend. Just see, give him a field pass and see how he does. And I held my own. I got my foot in the door and just have kept doing interviews for, God, 32 years since then. My first interview was Pat Combs, the old Phillies pitcher, if you remember him, when he was a phenom in the spring of 1990. He had just come up in 89 and gone 4-0 at the end of the year, first-round draft pick and everything. And he had a pretty good year that year. Didn't last too long, but we became really good friends, and he was the first guy I ever interviewed in Clearwater. And, you know, Chris Wheeler showing me down to the bleachers out beyond the right field wall and talking to Pat. And, you know, it became something that, just a world that I really wanted to be in. You know, I wanted to be part of that ecosystem wherever I fit in. And that's one of the great things about being a baseball writer, is that you get access. You get really good access. It's come back all the way now since COVID. And, you know, that's we were worried that, you know, it might go away, but we have clubhouse access before every game, after every game, field access, spring training access is usually really good. So you really get a chance to know these guys, I think, on a little bit of a deeper level than maybe you would in the other sports. And you get a chance to tell their stories and tell the stories of what really went on and ask your questions, you know, and find out, follow your curiosity. And I've got kind of an endless curiosity about baseball, so that works out pretty well for me. My first book, you know, was about the history of baseball through pitching, through all the different pitches. And I felt like, you know, being here in Philadelphia, I felt like the Phillies have always kind of got a little bit of a, you know, overlooked in the grand scope of baseball history, you know, for various reasons, and mostly because they lost a lot. They've lost more than any pro sports team. But they've made a lot of big impressions in the world of baseball and in pitching. And so I made sure to include all the Phillies, all the great pitchers in that book and all the different kinds of pitches they threw, whether it was Grover Cleveland Alexander and his sinking fastball all the way to Cole Hamels and his changeup to Brad Lidge's slider and lefty's slider and, you know, Robin Roberts' fastball and all that stuff. So I really tried to give the Phillies their due in the first book and again in this book. You know, Philadelphia has a lot of history in the World Series. The Phillies, this was their eighth trip to the series. They've won twice. And the Philadelphia A's, before the Phillies, you know, had won their first in 1980, the A's won five. The A's, incredibly, still have more championships than any other pro sports team in Philadelphia. And the A's haven't been here since 1952. You know, they went to Kansas City first. It was a pit stop on the way to Oakland. So and now they might go to Vegas someday. But the A's are long gone, but their five championships is still one more than the Eagles, although this year the Eagles are going to tie it, so the Eagles will get their fifth this year. And, you know, the Sixers only have a couple, and the Flyers have a couple, and the Phillies have a couple. So the A's, part of baseball history. And if I'm talking about the World Series, the history of the World Series, you gotta have a lot early in that book with Connie Mack and his A's. And so that was part of the fun of this book, was doing the research on those series and the early days of the series, because, you know, I know I have a weird sort of, my friends can tell you, like just a really bizarre kind of memory trick that I can just remember pretty much every World Series game that I've ever seen, you know, for going back to, well, the first one I saw was 82, but really going back to the late 70s, I can just remember all of them and who started, you know, who the starting pitchers were and what happened in the games and how the formats of the series went, you know, who won which games. But from the earlier ones, a lot of it's like, well, the Giants were really good and the A's were really good, and then you had some Red Sox and Pirates thrown in and the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Yankees. So, like, you know, Cardinals, I kind of had a general idea. But really diving in, particularly with the A's, you see, like, how all the stuff we see now in baseball really has happened before. It's not new. I mean, 1911, Connie Mack's playing against, the A's are playing against the Giants, and afterwards John McGraw and the A's win, and John McGraw is very complimentary and impressed by what Connie Mack did, which is he said he had his pitchers throw to the batter's strengths so they would hit them to the places that they usually hit the ball, and he shifted all of his fielders to that area where he was going to hit the ball, and instead of trying to pitch the hitter's weakness and get him to, you know, so like Connie Mack was like doing wild defensive alignments, apparently, way back in 1911. And now that became such a thing in the last few years that baseball's like, all right, we got to stop it with all these crazy shifts because left-handed hitters can't get a hit anymore, can't get a single anymore. So everyone's just trying to put it in the stands. So Connie Mack, you know, was on that idea, you know, 111 years ago. 1929, his next dynasty, after he had torn it all down and then invested in young players, you know, all the Al Simmons and Jimmy Fox and Lefty Grove and all these guys, when they were in their teens or 20s, he bought them and they became champions. So that was a winning strategy, time tested. But in 29, they were playing the Cubs. And the Cubs, you know, he thought would be susceptible mostly to right-handed pitchers. So he lined up his starting staff with all right-handers. And that meant that Lefty Grove, who was like in the conversation for the greatest pitcher of all time, Lefty Grove pitched out of the bullpen. And it's like you're using your, you know, your best arm in relief. But he was, you know, that was the way he was matching up. You know, he was matching up his pitchers versus their hitters and using Lefty Grove as sort of the relief ace. You know, he closed out game two. He closed out game four. They beat the Cubs. Connie Mack famously started an old pitcher named Howard Emke in game one because he had kind of a junk baller stuff that could beat the Cubs, and he struck out 14, and he did. So Connie Mack was thinking way ahead of his time. They didn't call it analytics then, and they didn't have all the data to show exactly where the balls would go, but he was thinking pretty far ahead, and all that happened here in Philadelphia. There's not much to talk about Phillies World Series-wise in the early days. They made it in 1915, and they won game one behind Grover Cleveland Alexander. And then Herbert Hoover came. No, not Herbert. It was 1915. Woodrow Wilson came. He was the first president to attend a World Series game right here in Philadelphia for game two. And it began an 8-game losing streak for the Phillies in the World Series that didn't end until 1980, long after Woodrow Wilson had left the scene, because they lost the last 4 games of that series to Boston, and they got swept by the Yankees in 50 and didn't make it again until 80. So it was a long, long time between appearances there for the Phillies, but they made them memorable. 1940 was not a Phillies World Series, but it was the Reds and the Tigers. And one guy I was only vaguely aware of until I began my research was a pitcher named Bucky Walters. He was MVP of the league in 39, went to Germantown High, right around the corner. Philadelphia guy. He lived till 1991, and he's buried out in Ambler, where very close to where I grew up. So Bucky Walters, in 1940, he won game two for the Reds, and then he won the clinching game six, and he hit a home run. So one of the fun things I had in this book was I went back and kind of retroactively gave World Series MVPs for all the World Series before the award was created. The award wasn't created until 55. Johnny Padres got the first one for, you know, lifting the Brooklyn Dodgers to the championship. And then Don Larson got the next one for pitching a perfect game, and which he had already gotten the award before the series ended. And Yogi Berra's like, I just hit 2 home runs in game six. Where's my, you know, game seven? Where's my car? But Yogi didn't get it. But so Bucky Walters, a Philadelphia guy who got the job done for the Reds. Phillies, as I said, made it in 1950. The Whiz Kids, Richie Ashburn and Robin Roberts and Del Ennis and all the guys. And it's funny to think how stuff comes around and how some stuff does change. Jim Constanti was the MVP that year. He was a reliever. He pitched all 74 games in relief, 150 innings. They don't use him like that anymore. So Jim Constanti, the World Series comes around. What do the Phillies do? They use their best pitchers. So Jim Constanti pitches game one. He pitches 8 innings. He lost like 1-0, but like he started the game and pitched 8 innings. This is your bullpen ace. He hasn't started all year. And he goes 8 innings in game one. And he doesn't pitch in game two. He pitches in game three in relief, and then he pitches 6 1/3 innings in game four in relief. That's all in 4 days. He pitched 15 innings in the span of 4 days, and he was a relief pitcher. But he was their best arm, so they went with him. And that's what the analytics guys say you're supposed to do, right? It makes sense. That's what I thought Rob Thompson did so well in game one. Like he used Suarez out of the bullpen. He used Dominguez early. He got the key outs when he needed them. Because we remember the LCS against San Diego. San Diego had Josh Hader, who was really good by that time in the season. He had figured out his problems. Josh Hader pitched 1 inning in that whole series. He pitched, to protect a 3-run lead. He pitched 1 inning out in San Diego, and that's it. And they were willing to lose all 4 games without using a guy who might have been their best pitcher, or at least their nastiest pitcher. So it just sort of shows that, like, you know, even though the Phillies got swept in that series, at least they went down with their best guy, given all he had, and Robin Roberts, too, in that series. So, nothing against Bob Melvin. He's a terrific manager. But it was a little curious when you think, that series is over, and they used Josh Hader for 1 inning? Like, the Phillies were going to win it anyway. But so 1980, Phillies make it back. And we all know all the stories about 1980. But one of my favorite little stories was how I reached out to Del Unser. Now, when I was an intern at the Phillies in 1995, I interned for the PR department after my magazine after I'd finished up my magazine that year, our magazine. And so Del Unser was working in the Phillies front office, and I was one of the guys who would, photocopy the clips. This was sort of before the internet, I guess. And I would go down, I'd open up all the newspapers, cut out the articles, and, tape them up to a paper and just distribute the clips packet to all the executives. So it's always funny to me to think, like, Del Unser is a guy who, 15 years earlier had been a World Series hero for the Phillies, and I'm dropping off clips every morning, and now here I am interviewing for a book. He was in my Unsung Heroes chapter because if you grew up in a very specific time frame, like I did, born in 1975, and you would probably ask the person, if you paid close attention around here, who would you want at bat, who would you want to be hitting if you needed one clutch hit? I would say Del Unser. you might say Mike Trout, or you might say, Derek Jeter or whoever. I'm going with Del Unser. And that, again, you have to be a really specific time and place to have that answer. But I told him that, and he's like, well, the backstory was he had been with the Phillies. He went to Montreal. In 1978, he was with the Expos, and he was an awful pinch hitter, which I didn't know. He was 3-for-38. He hated it. He didn't know how to do it. He went up there hacking, just mad that he wasn't a starter anymore. But he was really humbled. The game humbles you. You realize, like, all right, you stink at this. Like, and the league doesn't see you as a starter anymore, so what are you going to do? So he calls Paul Owens during free agency, and Paul Owens is like, where are you? He's like, I'm playing in a racquetball tournament out in Las Vegas. He goes, racquetball tournament? He's like, you want to play baseball? You come over here to the stadium and play baseball. So, like, he leaves the racquetball court, and this is, like, in December, and then he shows up at the vet, like, the next day. He took, like, a red eye, and he's like, well, Paul, you told me to come. And he's like, wow, okay. It impressed him, and he signed him, and he became an extraordinary pinch hitter. He had three hits. I think two of them were pinch hits, big pinch hits, off of Dan Quisenberry, the submarining closer for the Royals in 80. And one of them was a pivotal hit in Game 2, which they won. And the other one was the tying hit in Game 5, which was probably the most important hit of the series because the Phillies won that game and, of course, came back to the vet and won Game 6. So three hits from a guy who had three pinch hits the entire season 2 years before. Funny thing about Quisenberry, too. Dan Quisenberry was a great pitcher, right? Think about a closer who faced 43 Phillies batters in that World Series. 43 Phillies batters, not a single one struck out. When you think about baseball today, especially the closers coming in, he's going to strike out at least one an inning, usually half the, not usually half the batters, but close to that sometimes. And that was an elite closer, 42 years ago, who didn't get any strikeouts at all in 43 batters. He pitched every game in the World Series. I thought that was funny. Another way baseball has changed, as reflected in that 80 World Series, was, I went back before I interviewed Mike Schmidt for this book. I watched all of his at-bats in both World Series that he played in. And it amazed me to see him bunt in Game 3 in Kansas City and again in Game 4 in Kansas City. So it's interesting. You don't see anybody or barely anybody bunt anymore, let alone, the best player in the league. So Game 5 comes around. The Phillies are losing by a run in the ninth inning. Quisenberry's on the mound. And George Brett's playing third base, and Jim Frey, the Royals manager, tells him to come in because, you got to guard against the bunt. Even against Mike Schmidt, you got to guard against the bunt because we just saw him bunt twice in the series, so be aware. George Brett's like, okay. So he moves up a little bit, and Mike Schmidt just hits a rocket of a single right past him. Now, if Brett had been playing in normal infield depth, he would have had the range to get to that ball. But because he was playing in, thinking about the bunt, Schmidt was able to get the single that started the game-winning rally in Game 5. So just that idea that a hitter could do more than just swing for the fences, could play situational baseball, put his ego aside. This is the best power hitter in the game, best player in the game that year, best third baseman of all time. And the fact that he could bunt, just put that in the Cardinal, in the Royals' mind, and he got the big hit in Game 5 before Unser's big hit, and away we go. So, 83, Phillies' next World Series, and that's really where I begin my story. I got to go to games 4 and 5, the last two games against Baltimore. And it was not one of those World Series that stands out in the annals of the game, but for me, it does. And I still think it was pretty good. I mean, you had 7 Hall of Famers plus Pete Rose. You had Joe Morgan, Tony Perez, remember the old Big Red Machine had come over to the Phillies, Mike Schmidt, Steve Carlton, Jim Palmer, a young Cal Ripken, and Eddie Murray. None of them except Eddie Murray got back to the World Series, and all of them were, baseball legends, like big name A-list Hall of Famers. So it was a pretty exciting array of players out there. You had Gary Matthews, who had just won the MVP against the Dodgers, and he had flair, and he was really hot at the time. You know, you had this old veteran Phillies team called the Wheeze Kids. And it's funny because no World Series, I always look at the patterns of how these series go, right? And no World Series has gone this way since then, with the team on the road winning the first game, right? So you think, all right, great. You know, like it's as David Robertson said this year, he's like, well, now that we won one here, we can go home and finish it off in Philly. You know, like that. So that's what you're thinking. Like as a fan, you're thinking, all right, we won game one down in Baltimore, lose game two. It doesn't really matter. You think because, all right, it's we got the next three at home. And then you lose all three at home to lose the World Series at home. Like, you win game one on the road, you're never thinking you're going to lose the next four. That hasn't happened since then. So that was my experience as a young Phillies fan, which I think is the most is the toughest format for the series to go, because you get your hopes raised, and then you lose it at home. You know, like, if you were to lose the first two, if you were to win the first two at home and then lose the series, well, you're not going to do it on your home turf. So I had to watch those guys, my heroes, lose the series on that Sunday at the Vet. But I tell you what, as the years go on, it's almost like it doesn't matter. Like, that was what I had. That was my experience. And it was magical. And I swear I think about it almost every day. There was something about going to an afternoon World Series game, which they haven't had in 35 years, an afternoon World Series game with my mom, with great seats, beautiful sunshine, close game. They lost 5-4, but it was really interesting. A lot of substitutions, came down to the last batter. It was something special, a blimp in the sky, the feeling that the whole baseball world was, maybe the whole sports world was watching my guys in my park, not in some neutral stadium in Minnesota or Jacksonville or whatever. This is our ballpark and my town, and it's all happening right here, And the next night, going with my dad, was a twilight start, and they lost 5-0, and that was a very incredibly quiet Vet Stadium. I think the fans were not even so much like mad, like Philly fans get mad. Like, it was just sort of like, what just happened? Like, how did we lose all three games at home? And I talked to Marty Bystrom, who pitched in that game, and he said, yeah, he was a young pitcher, and he said he thought the same thing. He went home in his townhouse near the Vet, and he's like, how the hell did that just happen? Like, we have Mike Schmidt and Joe Morgan and Pete Rose and Steve Garland, all those guys. How do we lose all the games? But it happens. The Orioles were good, and that began a 10-year stretch of not much for the Phillies until 93, and we all remember 93, and 08, 09, 22. So the Phillies have certainly taken their turn. And one of the things I realized this year, covering the Phillies run here in 22, was that it's pretty cool that even though the Phillies finished last a lot, and they've had their ups and downs, every generation of fans in this town going back to 1950 has had their World Series team, including, and I'll include the 64 team, because that team obviously lost the pennant late in the year. They didn't make it to the series, but it was such a, from what I've told and what I've understood, such a wonderful summer, such a uplifting summer, and such a crushing September, that it was almost as memorable as a World Series team would be, and it left sort of a psychic scar. But every generation has their group like that, like the Wiz Kids group. And then 14 years later, you have the 64 team. And then 16 years later, you have the 80 team and the 83 team. And then 10 years after that, you have the crazy 93 team with all the long hair and the beards and the bellies and all that, and then losing up in Toronto. But what a crazy ride. And then 15 years later, you get the 08, 09 group that was so good for 5 years. And they got to two series and they won one and they brought the championship back to Philly. And now 14 years later, you have the Bryce Harper team. The team, the bedlam at the bank, and running through the playoffs all the way to Houston and just running out of steam a little bit at the end, but giving you hope of good days ahead, and the ownership invested in the team. They brought in the right guys. Now they've got some young guys coming up, and that it seems like it's coalescing again here. So every generation, I feel like, if you break it up into those 15 or so year spans, has that memorable team to really hold on to. And I think that helps perpetuate the tradition of baseball in this town. And yes, the attendance is going to ebb and flow a little bit if the team's really bad, but there is a core of baseball lovers in this city that never leaves, that never stops paying attention. And that, yes, we always hear about how the Eagles are number one. I love the Eagles, but you know, the Eagles are the number one team. I get it. But you gotta, you know, football's one game a week, right? You know, they really ask you to watch 3 hours, 3.5 hours. That's about all it requires. Baseball, to be a fan, like, you're gonna invest a lot more time, even if you're a casual fan, in following those games. There's 6 or 7 games a week. You know, even if you miss one or two of them, and even if you don't sit down and watch every pitch, it still washes over you. It's still a part of you. And I feel like Philadelphia fans, like a lot of fans, really, really care, but also really want to be heard and want to be part of the action. And even though they lost games 4 and 5 to the Astros, I think you really saw that this postseason. I don't think home field advantage makes much of a difference, really. Historically, it doesn't. You know, more World Series have been clinched on the road than at home, actually. But in Philadelphia, I think it kind of does. The players say it does. It's a different intensity than even New York or Boston. It's just something different about it here because the fans, I think, see themselves as part of it, and they feel so let down, so hurt almost, if the Phillies don't respond and win for them. But that's how much they care and how seriously they take it. So it was cool to see the Phillies. First of all, this season they played every possible home game. Nobody was left with unused tickets. You know, they played both games scheduled against Atlanta, won them. All three games scheduled against San Diego and won them, and then won that first one against Houston. So they almost ran the table at home like they did in 08. So it's a special sports town. It means a lot to me, even though I haven't lived here in a long time. And it was important to me to tell those Philly stories within this book, to be able to talk to not just Mike Schmidt, but also the Dell Hunters and Marty Bystroms and guys like that. That was part of the fun of it for me. It was the access that we have. You know, I'll run into a lot of people, you know, broadcasters who I've gotten to know, like Jim Palmer and Oral Hershiser and, you know, greats of the game, Dennis Eckersley, like that. I'll run into them and get to know them a little bit. But it was sort of the treasure hunt of tracking down, you know, a Gene Larkin who got the game-winning hit, the walk-off hit in Game 7 of the 91 World Series, Twins and Braves, best World Series I've ever seen on TV, you know, to track down Gene Larkin. You know, to track down John Stuper, who pitched the first series I saw in 82, and I really liked the Brewers because I hated the Cardinals because they were a Phillies rival, and they had Lonnie Smith, and that really bothered me because Lonnie Smith was good. The Phillies, remember that? They traded all those guys. They traded, like, Lonnie Smith. They traded, like, the 84, right? I mean, how 84 was, like, both MVPs had been traded by the Phillies. I was like, we just had these guys. We just had, you know, we had Ryan Sandberg, and we had Willie Hernandez, and now they're MVPs. But anyway, so like to be able to track down people like that, John Stuper, who beat the Brewers in 82 when Brewers had a chance to clinch in St. Louis, and this kid pitched a complete game as a rookie, and he's pitching through rain delays, and maybe it hurt him long term. He went on to be the coach at Yale for 30 years, and he's like, but I've never regretted it. I wanted to pitch all 9 innings. I wanted to save the bullpen for Game 7. Everything worked out just the way I wanted. I got the ring. Did it hurt? Long term, I don't know. You know, to pitch all those innings late in the season through rain delays, doesn't matter. It's like, that's what it's all about, and I love that sort of thing. So it was very rewarding to talk to all manner of those guys. You know, Steve Carlton was my favorite player. He was the one I absolutely had to get for the pitching book, and Mike Schmidt was the one I absolutely had to get for this book because I remember, like, I was talking about the bunts. Schmidt was so on his game in 80 after all those playoff disappointments and poor performances by him in the playoffs. Once they get to the World Series, he is in a great frame of mind. He's locked in. He's driving with Tug McGraw to Game 6 from their home out in media, I think. And you know, they're stopping for ice cream on their way to Game 6, and they're choreographing how they're going to celebrate the last out. You know, that's how locked in and fired up they were. And having Carlton on the mound helped too. But then 3 years later, Schmidt hits great. You know, he has a great LCS against the Dodgers. Then he gets the World Series. A couple of things start not going his way. And he's 1-for-20 with a broken bat single. And he's not going the other way. He's not taking his walks. You could just see he was just in his own head. Even as an 8-year-old kid, I could just see, I'm like, God, this is not my guy. What's wrong, Schmidt? And he was very honest, talking about how the pressure, he thrived on the pressure in 80. But in 83, he let the pressure get to him. And I thought it was really cool that he could share that about a guy who's at the same stage of his career, you know, could be so confident and using the pressure to his advantage, and then 3 years later have the opposite happen. So that was kind of the crux, or I felt an important part of the first chapter on just dealing with pressure and handling all the World Series pressure. Because certain guys like Reggie Jackson, you know, were really good at it pretty consistently. And some of their guys had their hard times. But the one thing I found throughout the research was that the more the at-bats pile up, the more the games pitched pile up, the more each player tends to perform to his career standards, right? I mean, Derek Jeter's career stat line is almost identical in the postseason as it is in the regular season. You know, Justin Verlander, we saw he hadn't won a World Series game, and it was a whole big deal. But you look at his whole career, he's made, you know, about a full season worth of starts, and he's 16-11 in the postseason. That's a pretty typical year, you know, give or take a couple. But 16-11, that's not bad. Andy Pettit, same thing. Like, you know, he has a lot of big moments, so you think of him as a big game pitcher. And he did have a lot of great moments because he was great, but he also had some tough ones. And it all kind of comes back to generally who you are. And that's why certain guys like Reggie with a 755 slugging percentage in the World Series, that really stands out. Or Curt Schilling or Bob Gibson, who were just so, so great, but so much even greater in the postseason. That's when it really stands out, is because they've got something of a sample size. And you say, oh, this guy, you know, maybe had a different mentality. And it's a source of debate, you know, like can certain guys turn it on and turn it off? I don't really think so. You know, why does David Fries have the October of all Octobers for the Cardinals in 2011, MVP of the LCS against Milwaukee, MVP of the World Series against Texas, and another good series in 18? But then, oh, by the way, in between, he hit like 150 in the 13 World Series against the Red Sox. We don't talk about that, but it's the same guy. I don't think he just decided that he wasn't going to hit well that year. So it's tough sometimes to ascribe sort of clutchness to human beings. It's sort of like home field advantage. When it helps you, it matters. But when it doesn't, what do we make of that? So I try to unravel that mystery in the book. And that was what I felt like was more important to do with this book, was I didn't want to do a chronology. You know, I felt like that's been done. And when I go to look at a chronology, the first thing I look at is what year it was made and what series are missing from it. You know, like if it was made in 2015, I know it's not going to have the Cubs championship in there. I know it's going to have nothing about the Astros. It's going to have, you know, it's going to be missing the Nationals and the pandemic series with the Dodgers. And it's just, so every book, of course, has a publication date, but I felt like it would be a better approach to look at themes like pressure in the series, or like unsung heroes, or like, you know, guys who failed in the big moments, the goats, the way we used to think of goats, not greatest of all time, but the scapegoats, managing in the World Series. You know, talk to Terry Francona and Joe Torre and Bruce Bochy and Tony La Russa, and a lot of managers who've had the chance to be in that crucible, and how they made those choices. Going, you know, researching back to Connie Mack and John McGraw, general managing a team, you know, how do you build a World Series team? What works? What doesn't? What's the, you know, how do you get to that stage where the players and coaches and managers can do their thing? And then for the big moments, I felt like anybody buying the book would be pretty well versed in the basics of the big moments. So I wanted to take people a little bit behind the scenes, maybe not behind the scenes, but sort of give them a sidebar story to the big event, you know, something that set up the big moment. Like Kirk Gibson's home run. Everybody's heard of Kirk Gibson hit the big walk-off home run when he was injured and was only at bat of the series, and Eckersley, the backdoor slider on 3-2. We've heard of all that. But if you really dig into it, there was bases empty and two outs, and Tommy Lasorda calls for a different pinch hitter first, a guy named Mike Davis. Mike Davis hit 196 that year. You know, chances are Dennis Eckersley is going to get him out, and Gibson never comes into the game. But Gibson had told, you know, they were going to take anything they get from Gibson. He had told Tommy Lasorda, he's like, have Davis pinch it with two outs, and then I'll come. He gets on, then I'll come up. You know, so sort of a qualified, I'll be the hero thing. You know, he wanted to, he wasn't going to come up there just to get, you know, to try to tie the game with a home run. So he wanted Davis to come up there first. So Mike Davis comes up there first. Mike Davis was let go by the A's, not re-signed by the A's, because he didn't walk very much. But he hit for power that year, And who was his teammate that year on the 87 A's was Dennis Eckersley. And Eckersley's pitching against him, knowing that a home run will tie the game. And so he's way too careful. Now, Dennis Eckersley would face 95 more batters in his postseason career and not walk any of them. But he walked Mike Davis, and that was a big problem because it brought up Kirk Gibson. Davis is on first base. He decides to steal second. Now, if he's caught, Gibson again doesn't get a chance, but he makes it. And at that point, Gibson can think smaller, and hitters always say that, you know, when you're not trying to do too much, when you're just trying to hit it up the middle or hit it to left field to get the tying run in, you know, then your approach is correct, and, you know, and we all know what happened. But none of it happens without this faded former power hitter who rarely walked getting a walk against a Hall of Famer who never walked anybody. And that sets up Gibson. So that was the stuff I loved, you know, writing about the Black Sox World Series. You know, there's been books and movies made about all the particulars of who took what money, when and why, and all that stuff. But did you ever realize, like, there was another team in that series? And, it, you know, we always think that of the White Sox as handing this series to the Cincinnati Reds. Well, the Reds were really good. That Reds team was actually better than any of the big Red Machine teams, had the best winning percentage in team history. They were primed to upset the, you know, it wouldn't even be an upset. I wrote, like, they were a better team. The White Sox had a Hall of Fame pitcher, Red Faber, was out for the series anyway, so they were already down an ace. The Reds had been put together by Christy Mathewson, pretty smart baseball guy, and they were primed to win it anyway. So I try to give the Reds their due as a way to look at the Black Sox series. So I do those things throughout that chapter, and you know, hopefully you'll read it and enjoy it and learn a little bit and, you know, have as much fun reading it as I did researching it and talking to these people. I love that all you guys came out on a cold night in December to listen to me and to talk about baseball. And I know baseball fans love talking baseball. So I'm happy to take questions once we get some microphones out there.
So great talk. Love your work in the Times. I'm a big Phillies fan, too. My question is, you talked about the themes of the book and the people that you cited to illustrate those themes. Where was there anybody living who would you could not speak with as part of the book? And also, who is no longer living from a previous World Series who you really wish you could have spoken with if they were still around?
Yeah, wow. Well, I mean, there's some that are obviously really unrealistic, you know, like... So Babe Ruth, what was really going on when you – did you really call that shot? You didn't really call that shot, did you? You know, like Christy Matthews said, how did you pitch three shutouts in like a six-day span in 1905? Like were you hurt or were you hurting the next day? Like I would love to ask him about how he recovered. You know, so those guys have, you know, been dead forever. But, you know, I consciously – there were certain guys who I felt like have given their story so many times that I didn't even really – bother. That's why I sort of made the decision, you know what, I could probably get Kirk Gibson and he would probably give the same answers, but let me talk to Mike Davis, you know, that sort of thing. A few guys I did reach out to who didn't want to talk, like Whitey Herzog, for example, he didn't really want to talk about some of his managing moves in the 80s. The umpire who blew the call in that 85 series, Don Denkinger, I reached out to him, he didn't get back to me. So a few others, but for the most part, you know, I was able to work around it. And like Bobby Bonilla, for example, like Bonilla, a great little anecdote about how the Marlins were getting shut out by Cleveland in game 7 in 97. And Bonilla was leading off after the seventh inning stretch. And Joe Black, who had pitched for the Brooklyn Dodgers in the early 50s, was sitting in the front row with Leonard Coleman, the president of the National League at the time. And he beckoned Bobby over and he said, hey, you know, he's been pitching you inside all night. Why don't you take a step off the plate and, you know, you'll be able to get your hands out and clear. And Joe Black was thinking of what had happened to him in Game 7 when Mickey Mantle had taken a step or two back subtly from the plate after Black had crowded him earlier in the at-bat. And then Mantle went deep in the crushing blow in that Game 7 in 52. So I think it was 52. So... you know, I was able to talk to Leonard Coleman instead because Bobby just never got back to me. But Leonard Coleman was great, you know, talking about being right there for the conversation, sitting next to the late Joe Black and sort of being part of the three people involved in that conversation, and how Bonilla came back to the dugout and sort of winked at, or you know, pointed at Joe Black, and then the Marlins went on to win. But that sort of, you know, that got them their first, that sort of got them going, because up until then the story was Jarrett Wright. So yeah, so they're always guys you want to get, and maybe you can't, but you know, for the most part, I think I was able to get just about everybody I tried.
Hi. I think you've described the Philly fans so well, so the psychic scars of 64. And I know in 80, the town was just, I went to one of the games and couldn't sleep really before the game. It was just so exciting. So I guess I'm curious, is this something you discern because you're a longtime Philly fan? Is this what happens because baseball is so personal? There are so many games and you get so just attached to your teams. Does every town get as personal as I think Philadelphia does about their teams? And it's just such a bummer, you know, when they lose.
Yeah, I think I've always felt that Philadelphia, I mean, every city loves their team when they're winning. And I asked Harper about that because I'm like, you know, yeah, everywhere you go, they're going to win. I mean, the Nats fans get excited when they win. But there's something different. He was talking about how they really feel like they're part of it. They're part of the team. You know, they sit in the stands, but they're involved. And I feel like Philadelphia fans, because I am one, you know, have two speeds, and that's maybe, let's say, irrational overconfidence and utter devastation and personal harm was done to me. You know, like, because, like, no matter what, the Eagles can be so bad, and I'm just like, no, they're going to win. They're going to win this week. I don't care. You know, of course they're going to win. And then when they don't, it feels like, how dare you? Like, I expected a win, and you did this to me. So I feel like that's where the negativity supposedly comes from. It's because they always expect to win, and I think that's what people, maybe I'm wrong, but it's always been my theory, is that's what people misunderstand about Philadelphians, is that Philadelphia sports fans, I think, always expect to win every single game. It's not like, you know, the way it was in other cities where they might have a history of losing, but they're like, oh God, what's going to go wrong today? You know, I'll watch them and they're just going to blow it. I feel like Phillies fans strut in every game like, no, we're going to win this. We're going to win this 12-0. Birds by a million this week. You know, like everybody. So you get your expectations really often unrealistically high, and then it's really crushing. And maybe I'm not quite that way because I looked at 93. I mean, I was 18, but I looked at 93 and I was like, God, what a run. Like, it was just like nobody, like Carter hit the home run and it sucked. But like, you know what, like, nobody, they were last place the year before. That was a great show, beginning to end. Even this year's Phillies team was, you know, it kind of took a while. A lot of dips and valleys. They were the last team to get in. They only won 87 games. The 93 team was like just a bolt of light, a joyous lightning from nowhere. And it didn't come back, and it wasn't there before. But everything came together, and that was just how the story ended. Like, it would have been great if they had won it, but it was like, it was almost appropriate to me as a fan that, like, they went down in a ball of flames. Like, they lost one of the games 15-14. That doesn't happen. Like, 15-14 in a swirling miss at home when you were leading by 5 runs. Like, that was weird. It was crazy. And then, of course, they get the shutout the next day. It's like, oh, my, you know, couldn't we have had a little bit of that pitching yesterday? And then they go up and they give up a walk-off home run. It was just like, it was so crazy. Like, that's how it had to be. So maybe I don't have the same kind of utter devastation, but I know a lot of people do, and the people still look at, you know, the 93 team as something that, you know, oh, it hurt so much. But I think if you really step back, it was, even this year, it was like, yeah, did you really think in September, you know, 21st or something, if you had said, I'm telling you nothing else about what's going to happen over the next month, but you're going to have a 2-1 lead in the World Series, would you take it? Of course you would take it. And then you'd see what happens. And if they lose the next three, okay, Houston was better. But, man, that was a fun run. You know, even though they lost.
Kind of say that the manager doesn't mean that much in baseball. Did the Phillies disprove that this year?
I think so. You know, I didn't think I thought when they fired Girardi, it was a sign that they were done. I think everybody did, everybody except Rob Thompson and those guys. I mean, I thought they would make the playoffs at the beginning of the year. Then when they got off to such a bad start, it felt like all the things you were worried about were coming true. And like everybody else, I had known Rob Thompson from the Yankee days, didn't realize what a hidden gem that they had in him and how much the players really needed that, needed a different approach, needed a guy who had no ego and yet was so well prepared and so caring about them that they could just be sort of free to be themselves. You know, he changes a few pieces around the bullpen. He didn't have Harper for 2 months, and he still kind of kept them going. The story I love about Thompson, you may know it, is how quickly they showed their affection to him by, for one of the road trips, they all wore suits. They surprised Rob Thompson by showing up on getaway day in a suit. And now, up until about 10 years ago, that was standard on a travel day. All the players wore suits on the road. It was a rule. But as sleep science has evolved and all that, they want players to be comfortable. It's usually like, you know, track suits. I mean, the Yankees, on travel days, the Yankees say, you know, dress code, track suits. You know, so it's, but Rob Thompson was raised to believe that that's how ball players looked. His first game he went to in Detroit, he was from Canada, went over to Detroit. His father pointed out to him, he said he saw the Tigers getting onto their bus after the game to go to the airport, and they were all wearing suits. And he said, that's what a big leaguer looks like, son. You know. And so Rob Thompson, even in the age of sweatpants and stuff on road trips, like Rob Thompson always wore a suit every getaway day. You know. And the players heard that story, knew that story, and just did that as their way to tell their manager very early on that, you know, they've got his back, and that, you know, I thought that was pretty cool. Now, you know, if they lose a few more games here and there, they don't make it, that story's not as big. But like, I just thought that was really cool, and the human side of things about how a manager connecting with his players can really make a difference. And fortunately for the Phillies, they have an organization now where, with a leader like Dave Dombrowski, and a dugout leader like Thompson, where they're smart enough to obviously understand the use of data and analytics and all that, how it can make you better, but they really do, I think, get the heartbeat side of it too.
What is momentum? No, I'm a psychiatrist, so I'll tell you what I think. And that it is a leader with followers. They have to have both. Mm-hmm. And something happens, some weird play, some magic, and people begin to believe in the group psychology, and that leads them to give an extra 5 or 10%, which sustains it until it doesn't. The question is, what is momentum? Because everybody talks about it.
Right.
I've never heard it defined.
Well, in baseball, the old cliche is, and there's always truth to it, is that momentum is the next day's starting pitcher, right? You know, it's, and I feel like that there is something to that in baseball, because it's the one sport where the most important player doesn't play every day. You know, in general, it's still the starting pitcher. Even in the 5-inning day and age, he's still pitching more than half the game, I think the expectation is. And yet he can't pitch the next day or the next day after that or the next day after that. So your expectations on each, and that's one of the things I love about baseball, is your expectations of the outcome changes every day based on who the most important player is. If the most important, if it's your number 5 starter, you have a much different chance of winning the game than you do if it's your number 1 starter. So, yeah, momentum as the next day starting pitcher really means something. I mean, Phillies couldn't touch Christian Javier, right? Like, they were as hot as can be. Going into game 4 with all those home runs off McCullers, and they couldn't touch Christian Javier. Now they're winning 2-1 in the World Series. They've got the home crowd, which has the home team is, the Phillies have won every game at home going into game 4. You've got Nola, because of the rainout, back on regular rest, and you get no hit because Christian Javier in the bullpen was just that good that day. So momentum in baseball is really tricky, because one really hot pitcher, one really tough pitcher can just unplug an offense. That's why you really need to see it over a long course of time. Like, I think the Rob Thompson arrival began to generate momentum. Now, in a short series, you know, you might not see it, but you give a big sample, and I think, you know, Thompson's records really showed that things were building one game after another, and you might hit a road bump like Christian Javier, but over time, like you said, maybe whether it's trying harder or just feeling better about your workplace, you can be more productive over time, and that's how momentum builds. But the short answer is the next day is starting pitcher.
As someone who watches the game so closely, what's your overall take on the health of the game right now? And then also, relatedly, what do you think about the new rules that are coming in next year and how that'll affect that, especially pitch clock, elimination of shifts, limits on pickoffs?
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I think those questions are intertwined. You know, the health of the game, I know that, you know, attendance drops a little bit every year, it seems. And I know that ratings are not, you know, national game ratings are not what they used to be. But I always maintain that how can anybody claim that an industry is suffering when you still, as a business, can sell 81 home dates a year and average around the league, like 27,000, 28,000 ticket buyers for 81 times a year. That's a pretty popular event, right? Like, I mean, basketball only has half of that, and they're playing in a much smaller venue. So people can talk all they want about, like, oh, basketball's my favorite sport, and maybe it is, but, like, you only have half the games, and if they could get average crowds of 28,000 in basketball or 50,000 on a good night, they would build arenas that big, and they don't. So, you know, football, hugely popular, it's once a week. So I think the amount of money and the amount of, you know, translated into tickets bought total because of the volume that baseball can sustain as a business indicates to me that baseball still has a huge hold on this country. Again, just because of the volume. Now, they have a big advantage, but if nobody was going to the games, you know, we would really see it. And 30 teams with 162-game schedules are still mostly, you're going to have Oaklands here and there, you're going to have Pittsburgh, you know, some teams that are down, Marlins. But for the most part, I think the industry is really healthy. And the new rules, I'm hopeful that it will get back to a little, I think it's just sort of like recalibrating. I think the game, in a way, got a little too smart, and that sounds weird, but like all that stuff, I'm talking about Connie Mack putting the fielders in the right position, like, That was really smart. Like when all the data analysts were like, why are we playing these guys in places that they don't hit the ball? Like, let's play them in places that they're likely to catch the ball. Like, it just made so much sense because it still looks weird and it still kind of offends the sensibilities of a lot of the fans. So taking away the shift, I'm really eager to see what happens. Will there be more athleticism seen by the fielders? For example, you know, like, will we see more great fielding plays because you're not right close to the ball all the time? Will we see more artistry of hitting rather than just trying, because there'll be more singles available supposedly than just trying to, you know, yank it over the fence, because anything else you put that's not over the fence, someone can catch it. So the one problem I think that will be really, really hard to get over, though, and pitch clock will help the game go faster, and the other rules you mentioned will incentivize speed, bigger bases and limits on pickoff throws, is I don't know how they're going to get around the fact that pitchers are just so good. You know, the pitchers throw really, really hard and have such advanced, even since I wrote the first book, the pitching book, have such advanced video capture. The Astros were leaders in this. How to throw new pitches, what pitches work best with your physiology, what pitches that you think might not be good but are really good, so if you work harder on it, you'll be a guy. The sophistication of pitching is something that they can't stop, no matter how much they try to legislate stuff. So unless you move the mound back, and I don't think that's going to happen because of injury fears, I do think the strikeouts are probably here to stay at this rate. I don't see that really coming down. You can say guys cut down on their swings. Maybe it's still really, really hard to hit.
Do you think that Pete Rose will be or should be considered for the Hall of Fame?
I feel like Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame. I don't think he should be working in baseball, because I think when you break a rule that everybody knows that if you break this rule, you can never work in baseball again, and you break the rule, well, that's the consequence. But what happened with Pete Rose was, you know, a player gets to be on the Hall of Fame ballot 5 years after he's retired. So 4 years after Pete Rose was retired in 1990-91, right before he was about to get on the ballot, the Hall of Fame saw this coming and said, we don't really want this guy in the Hall of Fame. We don't want this issue. We don't want to deal with this issue. So the board of directors of the Hall of Fame passed a rule that said if you are banned from baseball, you are also banned from the Hall of Fame. Now, up until then, guys who had been banned from baseball, like Shoeless Joe Jackson and the Black Sox from 1919, they were not in the Hall of Fame, but they were at least eligible. You know, they could be voted on. So Pete Rose has never had the chance to be voted on by any voting member, whether it's sports writers or whether it's former players on the smaller committees. And I think that's unfair. And I wish that they would at least allow him to have the chance to be voted in. Now, whether enough people held that against him, you know, that at least you'd have a fair hearing. I was encouraged by the fact that Rob Manfred, the commissioner, said that he doesn't think Pete should be banned from the Hall. But that's the Hall's decision, although Rob is on the board of the Hall. But in answer to your question, I would vote for him if I had a chance to put him in the Hall of Fame because officially the stuff that he did, you know, the gambling on the Reds was when he was a manager. And he has the most hits of anybody in baseball history. So, and most games played, most at-bats, bunch of, you know, three championships, all of it. And I think if he's going to ever make it, let's not wait until he's dead. Like, I it's always a shame when players get inducted after they died, and you could have inducted them when they were living. So, you know, that's my thought on that. Thank you. Good question.
I wonder, what do you think was the effect of Klintak and Ed Wade on the teams who played the World Series this year? And do you think they both got a bad rap or what?
I think the Phillies wound up where they needed to with Dombrowski. But, yeah, I think Matt did a lot more good things than, you know, you probably get credit for when you get fired when the team hasn't won yet. You know, it seems like the whole thing was a failure. But then you look at the championship roster, the NL championship roster, and a lot of those guys did come in when he was here. He had some missteps. I think, you know, to hear the veteran people around the Phillies, like they really wish they had been, you know, maybe consulted a little more and maybe, you know, didn't listen to the older guys as much as a Dave Dombrowski would, you know, to give Pat Gillick, you know, to listen to Pat Gillick's advice and Ed Wade and, you know, guys who'd been around. And maybe that was a failing of Matt. I always got along really well with Matt. I always thought he had a good plan. And what he said was, well, I remember what I'm saying is this, is that the plan will work. He's like this plan to, you know, wait it out, get some draft picks under the last current, you know, collective bargaining agreement, build the farm system, and then spend when the time is right. That was a winning formula, he believed. And I think this year we saw that it is becoming a winning formula. The problem was it just took too long. You know, there were a couple of years before this that I think, understandably, people kind of got impatient. You know, let's get this going here. And that cost him his job. But yeah, I think you know, I think we see that a lot. I think Ed also, I mean, poor Ed, you know, he had so much of a hand in the Phillies of 08, you know, and but he was gone by then, you know. And then the Astros, when they rose, they had several players who had been groomed under Ed. Ed's a good man. So funny real quick story about Ed Wade. I was talking to him in 80, I mean, about the 80 LCS, Phillies Astros, because he was with the Astros at the time. And he was just telling me, we were talking about Phillies stuff, and, you know, we were both actually Phillies PR interns. I was, as I said, in 95, and Ed was in 77, so we have that in common. And told me a story how one time Tug McGraw was just out shopping somewhere in San Francisco on a road trip, and he was at an antique store or something, and he saw a chair, like a very comfortable-looking chair, and he said, that looks like it'd be great for Paul Owens. I'm going to buy that for the Pope. And so Tug McGraw just had the people in San Francisco just ship this chair to Paul Owens, the Phillies general manager, and it was like Paul Owens' chair. And when Paul Owens died, like, Ed Wade got the chair. So he's like, I have the Pope's chair. And he's texting me a picture of the Pope chair. He's like, it's in my house. I love it. So I'm like, the Pope chair. That's pretty cool. So, you know, the Phillies are generally really good to the people who've been around the organization a lot. That's one thing I like about, you know, that organization is, you know, Middleton is he's a Philadelphia guy. You know, he understands the importance of, and he's shaking some things up for sure. But you know, of that continuity that Dave Montgomery was, you know, believed in so much, and Bill Giles before him. So it's, Phillies have a lot of those guys around, and you know, you're happy for them. I'm happy for the Astros, too. The Astros did a lot of things right, and they deserve to win. But I'm happy to see the Phillies people like that have success.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.